guys are going to love this. Really going to love this. I was doing the show thinking that I'm live. I got two stories in thinking I'm already on the air with you guys. And apparently I'm not. I'm going to re-rack it and I'm going to start it again. Oh, Lord. This is my day.
This is the After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
It was quite a bummer, because, boy, that first part of the show was really good. Oh, man. How could I have let that happen? I wasn't on the air, right? God, I'm so confused. Aloha, Louise. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. I'm telling you, I thought we were together already. I thought we were doing the show. Loser. No. Oh, man. Well, I guess I've had really good practice for the first two stories. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your patience, because that was a good 15 minutes that we were already, I was already doing the show, and yet I had forgotten to click the live button. I thought I did it. I just didn't. Oh, man. Yeah. You guys would have laughed at me sitting in my office doing the show to myself. Crap. Yeah, I was talking to the void. Exactly. I was talking to the void. I thought I was talking to you. Apparently, I wasn't talking to anybody. Oh, Lord. You guys are so nice to me. Look at you. Please, as Judy recommends, because I need all the help I can get today. Thank you, Judy. Please click the like button. Please click the subscribe button as well. Oh, some exciting news. I'm now at 1,907 subscribers, right? I'm well on my way to 2,000. So please, please click subscribe if you haven't already. Share the show. Let's see if we can push it to 2,000. Thank you for that. I really appreciate it. I do want to thank the folks that are supporting this show, because without you, I really couldn't make it happen. Clearly, I can hardly make it happen as it is. Please find the PayPal information in the show description, also in the About tab of the After Party Live. So thank you for all of that. Okay, now on with the real show. Now that we're really live, can we do it? Let's do it. There is a story that gives a little bit of hope in the wake of the devastating wildfire in Lahaina, Maui. And you guys know this place is really close to my heart. Devastated by wildfire. And Lahaina itself, the whole town, was designated an historic landmark. There are some amazing buildings there. 19th century buildings. The old Lahaina Courthouse. The Baldwin House. These are buildings that lost to history after this fire. Or maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe we could recreate them. Maybe we could rebuild in exactly the same way. Well, that's what they're trying to do at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, using cutting-edge technology to first digitally restore these historic buildings damaged by the Maui or destroyed by the Maui wildfires, and then possibly using the digital recreations, using AI tools to physically recreate the buildings exactly the same. So, are they lost to history? The originals? Yes. But it's pretty cool that you could rebuild them to be just about the same. So, more than 2,200 of Lahaina's buildings were damaged or destroyed, including the banyan tree, which is now coming back. That also offers us a little bit of hope, right? The Baldwin home, the master's reading room, old Lahaina courthouse, the Wohing Society Hall. These are the buildings being taken on by students in a course. The whole point of the class is to recreate these buildings, recreate these structures in a digital way. The dean of the University of Hawaii's at Manoa School of Architecture said he thought the visualizations would help people see that here's the first step toward the realization of what could be recaptured. So they're using this AI technology to recreate these buildings. There were 11 students that registered for this class. They split up into four groups, and they recreated those buildings that I just mentioned in a digital way. It's the first step to possibly getting them really rebuilt in a real way, not just a virtual way. They used artificial intelligence. They used these laser photos of the buildings to completely recreate them. Amazing. They had an opportunity to learn about architectural heritage from experts at the Hawaii State Historic Preservation Division. And so they used this program called 3D Presso. It's an AI-powered tool that turns videos into 3D models. They use something called Rhino 3D. Pardon me, losing my voice, because I was talking to no one earlier, because, you know, that was wasteful. That's a commercial computer-aided design software, and they use something called Lumion, which is a 3D rendering and animation software. And with these tools, they transform their findings into high-quality, three-dimensional renderings, and then presented them. And they're amazing. So students were saying the class focused on digital AI and 3D rendering, and they had never had a class like this before. Usually they were just learning about older stuff. AI and 3D modeling, the thought is, could change historic preservation. It could be the new way, because we're going to have more wildfires. We're going to lose more precious buildings that are important to culture and heritage, not only here in Lahaina, but around the world. Remember Notre Dame in Paris, right? I mean, we managed to rebuild that. What if the whole thing had been taken down? So we've got to go in and recreate these buildings just in case we need to rebuild them, because I don't see wildfires going away anytime soon. The principal at Civil and Environmental Consultants, his name is Matthew Bainbridge, says the processing power that you now have at your fingertips to be able to take overlapping photos and digitally recreate things has changed the survey industry. He said it's mind-blowing that you can create a digital twin of any structure, facility, or object. The work that he does relies on these laser scans or photogrammetry rather than blueprints or images. And he says the students learning this skill, it's awesome. Because again, we have this risk of damage from natural disasters. So now we have these tools to help us cope with the future. Something good about AI we don't hear very often. So here's There's another picture of Lahaina, sadly. Here's a story for people. Maybe you have this car if, I don't know, you get a lot of speeding tickets, you think? Yeah. I have a list of the cars that get the most speeding tickets. The list is compiled by Insurify, which is an auto insurance comparison site. And they looked at more than $4.6 million insurance applications. And they looked at the car brands most often cited for speeding. And they said the most frequently cited automaker is Infiniti. 8.7% of Infiniti drivers reported speeding tickets. Next on the list, the Scion, 8.4%. The Volkswagen, 8.3%. Got a Subaru? You're at 8%. Mazda, 7.7%. Audi, 7.6%. Same for Kia. Honda, 7.5%. BMW, I thought, would be higher on the list. 7.4%. Still makes the top 10. Number 10 is the Hyundai at 7.4%. The national average of speeding tickets is 7.1%. So again, the Infiniti gets 8.7% of speeding tickets. RAND did a survey as well. They found 8.6 million Americans are ticketed for speeding every year. The average monthly cost of insurance for a driver with a speeding ticket, $123, but that's a month. but it could be a lot higher based on your driving history. So slow down out there if you've got your Infiniti. They're looking for you. They know. They pull over a lot of Infinities, right? How about the situation at Pier 39? Remember, more than 1,000 sea lions, you can see on the right, swooped in to the docks at Pier 39. And I thought it was pretty cool. But apparently, the sea lions can't really handle the docks like this. So they had to kick them out. Look at the picture on the left. They had to boot them out and repair the docks so the sea lions could come back in. Just a week after the surge in sea lions at Pier 39, the harbor master said there were so many hanging out there that the floating docks were needing repairs. So the sea lions were temporarily scuttled out, shuffled out of there. The docks repaired. The work is done now. The harbor master says some of these sea lions may be cautious about coming back. They counted about 1,000 sea lions on the docks at Pier 39, which was the most they've seen in 15 years. So hopefully they'll come on back in. Because we love them, right? They're kind of part of the landscape now. I love this story about this officer. Here's a guy that's in the right place at the right time. You've got to love an animal-loving cop. And I mean, he really means business. There was this snake that was seen in the middle of a roadway. And he was called in and decided that he's going to go pick it up. And so he did. He had to chase it around for quite a while. Finally, picks it up, moves it off into a wooded area, sets it free. And he says, I'm just really, really an animal lover. I'm not scared of these animals. They mean a lot to me. And I just felt like I needed to get him to safety. And so he did. I mean, another officer might have thought, snake in the road, no big deal. But here he comes in, swooping in, catches the snake and sets it free. He's a nice guy. We like him. Another animal story for you. It's the last one of the day. This one a bit of a sad one about starving pelicans. This is a huge problem. They're finding these starving pelicans along the Monterey Bay coastline, Santa Cruz coastline. Southern California having a problem as well. The Santa Cruz Animal Rescue is treating more than 100 of these pelicans that are hungry right now. And they're inundated with calls about starving pelicans. They're asking for the public to be on the lookout for them. Even if they can, rescue the birds and bring them in. They say they're tired, but they're doing as much as they can to rescue these birds. Since early April, the Native Animal Rescue of Santa Cruz County has seen more than 100 injured and starving pelicans. One person said, when I walked up to this bird, it wasn't flying away. It had one wing move, the other wasn't moving. It's sad, really sad. A lot of these birds are underweight. About 30 have died in the care of this rescue. They have to be twice as heavy as they were before they were brought to rescue, before they're able to be released. And again, the problem is from the Central Coast to Southern California. It was first spotted early to mid-April. In far Northern California, it seems like the pelicans are okay. But from the Central Coast down to Southern California, they're not okay. A spokesperson for International Bird Rescue said, we're kind of dumbfounded as to exactly what's going on. They're not getting enough fish to eat. The diagnostic tests on them have revealed no disease, no bird flu type of thing going on with them. There was a similar situation in 2022 when about triple the amount of emaciated pelicans were turning up. But this time, the birds are being found further inland. Some of them severely injured, some tangled in fishing lines. Sometimes when they don't have enough to eat, they look in other areas, which means they'll get closer to a pier or a fishing dock or a fishing boat. They take a bigger risk because they just need to eat. So if you live in a coastal area, keep your eyes peeled for pelicans that are suffering. They might need some help. These ladies, I can't even tell you how much I love them. I mean, love them. This is the story that had me in tears. There is a school that it's a Catholic school, and it was developed for young African-American women. Most of the girls that go to this high school are on scholarship at this school. It costs $8,000 a year to go to this school. It is St. Mary's Academy in New Orleans. And it's an elementary school, middle school, and junior high, all the way through, K through 12. And something interesting about this school. So again, a lot of people underprivileged in this school, right? And one of the things they do from elementary school on is they tell you, you can do anything, you can be anything. That you have the capacity to be anything. That might be the magic ticket, the magic key. Underprivileged area, African-American young ladies, 100% graduation rate, 100% college acceptance rate at this school, St. Mary's Academy. Incredible. Now, listen to this. So, these girls, teenage girls, in their math class, and they're taking pretty advanced math, they're working on a school-wide math contest, and it came with a $500 cash prize. So you see here, there's two senior girls, Nakia Jackson and Kelsea Johnson. And they thought, $500? All right. That's good. I'm going to try. Nakia said, I was motivated because there was a monetary incentive. She said, $500 is a lot of money, so I'd like to at least try. And there was a bonus question on this math quiz. It was to create a new proof of the Pythagorean theorem. And it gave a few guidelines as to how you would start a proof. What it didn't say is that in 2,000 years, there's only been one successful proof. I mean, come on. So the Pythagorean theorem, right, is a fundamental principle of geometry. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. When you know the length of two sides of a right triangle, you can figure out the length of the third. That's what it's about. So both girls studied geometry and some trigonometry. They say math is not easy for them. They're not math geniuses. That's what they say. That they work at math. Math is not something, you know, they're not like a savant kind of thing. There have been more than 300 documented proofs of the Pythagorean theorem using algebra and geometry. But for 2,000 years, a proof using trigonometry was not thought to be possible. So they're interviewed on 60 Minutes. And Bill Whitaker is interviewing them. He says, when you looked at the question, did you think, boy, this is really hard? And they said, yeah. But they were motivated to try it. And Kelsea on the right says, when I start something, I try to finish it. And so they just kept going. For 2 months over the winter, they spent all their free time working on this proof. And the garbage can, her parents said the garbage can was full of papers. She'd work out the problems and then ball one up and throw it in the trash. She has a workspace in the garage. And there were papers all over the floor. Her parents were like, what is going on out there? Her mom said, I don't even look at the problem because most of the time I don't even understand what it is she's doing. The teacher said, I wasn't really looking for someone to solve it. I was looking for some ingenuity here. And these girls both came up with a proof, both of them. I mean, I don't know why it gets me so emotional, but I'm just so excited that they did this. And it just shows that if you're told that you can be anything, that you can do anything, that there's no limitations on you, you can have this kind of success. So they go on to explain how they came up with this proof, which honestly is beyond me. And the interviewer says, so you guys are math geniuses? And they say, no, no, I think that's a stretch. They said, well, if you're not geniuses, then you're really smart at math then? They said, not at all. The work was submitted to the American Mathematical Society Conference in Atlanta in March. And they're looking at these proofs. And it blew up. Insane. The accomplishment that these girls both achieved goes around the world. People are writing about them in South Korea. They get a commendation from the governor. They get keys to the city of New Orleans, a shout out from Michelle Obama. The interviewer says, why do you think so many people found you to be so impressive? And Nakia on the left says, probably because we're African-American and we're women and our ages. So he says, you think people were surprised that young African-American women could do such a thing? And they said, yeah, that's exactly right. It's so cool. But on the flip side, there's a lot of people saying, naysayers, I guess you could say. They're trying to shield the girls from this. People who are saying they couldn't possibly have done this. They had to have help. This is not what happens, right? It happened, and they both did it. Can you imagine not having something happen for 2,000 years, and here they go? Here they go. So again, this school, for 17 years, 100% graduation rate, 100% college acceptance rate. Pretty cool. They say college is all the girls at this school talk about. Now, we've talked a lot about how not everybody goes to college. College isn't right for everyone. But these young women who've been told the sky is the limit since they were in elementary school, who've been lifted up, who believe in themselves, who when they start something, finish it, who are motivated, they're going places. Absolutely. Interestingly, both of them say they don't intend to pursue math as a career. You would think someone who did something like this, that the first thing they would do would be, you know, math classes at Harvard. No, that's not what where their interests lie. I just thought that was really interesting. To a lighter story, a Swiss Army knife, kind of an old standby, an old staple, right? Well, is it really a Swiss Army knife if there's no knife blade? Because that's what they're doing. The new Swiss Army knife is a version of the classic multi-tool, and it won't have a blade. A spokesperson for Swiss firm Victorinox telling CNN they're in the early stages of developing pocket tools without blades. Now, they're not going to get rid of the ones with blades, but they're innovating the core of their brand, listening to the consumers and their needs, acknowledging there's an appetite for functionality, versatility, and craftsmanship, they say, and not the blade. I mean, I think if it's a Swiss Army knife, you kind of need the blade, don't you? Along with the scissors and the corkscrew and all the other stuff. Increasing concern over the prevalence of knife crime means the British government is considering new legislation on bladed articles. And so, because of this new stringent regulations on knives in many markets, they're taking out the blade. I guess it means that, perhaps, in some cases, you could get through security without having your Swiss Army knife confiscated if all you have are the little scissors and the corkscrew and the bottle opener and the toothpick, then maybe that's not such a threat. In England or certain Asian countries, you're sometimes only allowed to carry a knife if you need to have it to do your job or operate outdoors. But when you're in the city, you're going to school, you're at the movies, you're shopping, carrying pocket knives is severely restricted. In some places, these are seen as weapons rather than tools. And so that's why they're working on these new multi-tools for specific sports, outdoor activities, cycling, etc. They even have one specifically for golfers. So they have to get rid of the blade. I don't think we're getting rid of the blade here in America. Not in America. We like our guns and blades. Other countries? No, not so much. We were just talking on the Mark Thompson Show about climate change and pollution. The world's largest vacuum was just unveiled. And the vacuum sucks up air to suck climate pollution out of the air. This thing just opened. It's huge. It's the world's largest plant designed to suck planet heating pollution out of the atmosphere. They say it's like a giant vacuum. And it started operating in Iceland on Wednesday, today. They call it Mammoth. And it's the second commercial direct air capture plant opened by a Swiss company called Climeworks. It's 10 times bigger than its predecessor, Orca. That one started running in 2021. So first came Orca, now Mammoth. And Mammoth is a direct air capture, or DAC, technology designed facility. And the point of it is to suck in air and strip out the carbon using chemicals. The carbon left over can be injected deep beneath the ground, or it can be reused or transformed into solid products, what have you. The plan is, by Climeworks, to transport the carbon underground where it will be naturally transformed into stone, locking up the carbon permanently. They're partnering with Icelandic company Carbfix for this sequestration process. And the whole thing is powered by Iceland's abundant, clean geothermal energy. So, look at them doing their part. A lot of governments around the world are looking at this. People still burning fossil fuels. The air still needs to be cleaned. And concentrations of planet-warming carbon dioxide in the atmosphere hit a record high in 2023. Scientists say the world needs to find new ways to remove carbon from the atmosphere, in addition to cutting fossil fuels. But some people say this kind of technology is controversial, expensive, takes a lot of energy, not so much proven. And some people say that sucking the carbon out of the atmosphere really distracts from policies to cut fossil fuels. So if we can take it out, then we can just use as much as we can and pollute, pollute, pollute. That's not what they want to see either. One woman, her name is Lily Fuhrer, she's director of the Fossil Economy Program at the Center for International Environmental Law, calls the technology fraught with uncertainties and ecological risks. But they're doing it. This world's largest plant, 72 collector containers, that's the vacuum part of the machine that catches the carbon out of the air, stacked on top of each other. So they're going to keep building this. Mammoth is going to be able to pull 36,000 tons of carbon from the atmosphere a year at full capacity, which is about the same as taking 7,800 gas-powered cars off the road for a year. That's significant. Welcome aboard, Mammoth. They found something pretty interesting. And that is the part of your brain that acts like a compass. Research has pinpointed the neural compass of the brain activity that people use to orient themselves. It's a pattern of brain activity that helps prevent humans from becoming lost. Have you known people that don't have this capacity? They're out there. I don't know. For the first time, the internal compass that humans use to orient themselves and navigate through their environment has been pinpointed in the human brain. The study, published in the Nature Human Behavior Journal, it's the journal Nature Human Behavior. The hope is that the discovery will increase the understanding of diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, in which a person's navigation and orientation are often disrupted or impaired. Keeping track of the direction you're heading in, pretty important. Even small errors in estimating where you are and which direction you're heading can be disastrous. According to the lead researcher, his name is Benjamin Griffiths. He's a psychology fellow at the University of Birmingham in the UK. He says, we know animals like birds, rats, and bats have neural circuitry that keeps them on track, but we really knew surprisingly little about how the human brain manages this, and especially in the real world, how we do it. So tracking neural activity in people requires those that are participating to stay really still. But for this study, the researchers used EEG devices that are mobile to capture and analyze the brain waves of people as they were on the move. Small sample study, 52 people participated, moving their heads, sometimes just their eyes, to orient themselves based on cues from different computer monitors, while a scalp EEG device monitored the activity of their brain. They also did the study with another 10 people who actually had electrodes implanted in their brains for monitoring cerebral health problems like epilepsy. And what they found was a finely tuned directional signal in the brain could be detected just before a person turned their head toward a new bearing. That isolating the signals enabled them to focus on how the brain processes navigational information and how those signals work alongside other cues like visual landmarks. Pretty interesting. Now they're going to do some more grandiose research and take those findings a step further to figure out how we navigate through time and whether this type of brain activity is at all connected to memory. So, speaking of that, let's talk about Alzheimer's for a minute. Alzheimer's. Because there's a gene mutation that may signal a new genetic form of Alzheimer's disease. And it's thought that people who carry two copies of this gene mutation that's most strongly implicated in Alzheimer's are almost certain to develop brain changes related to this degenerative disorder. The study found that a single mutated APOE4 gene has been found to pose the strongest genetics-driven risk factor for late-onset Alzheimer's. Almost everyone with two copies of that gene wound up with higher levels of Alzheimer's-related brains by age 55 compared to people with another version of it. The study in the journal Nature Medicine. By age 65, more than 95% of people with two APOE4 genes showed abnormal levels of amyloid proteins in their cerebrospinal fluid, and 75% had positive scans for that. The findings suggest that having two copies of this gene could represent a new genetic form of Alzheimer's. This, according to folks at the memory unit at the St. Pau Research Institute Neurology Service in Barcelona, Spain. They've known about this gene for 30 years, and they've known that it's associated with a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's, but now they say they know almost everyone with the duplicated gene will develop that. That's about 2-3% of the population. So, important to know, because if you've detected as having the gene, they say you can start preventative treatment earlier. Maybe stave it off a little bit longer, right? That's the hope anyway. All right. How about this video? This is kind of an interesting thing. I've seen videos like this on, I don't know, when you go down the internet rabbit hole, right? Kind of go down the YouTube rabbit hole. And I've seen like repeated accidents happen like this, but this one just happened. So the video is interesting enough, I wanted to share it with you. You've seen dump trucks drive around with the truck flipped over, the back bed flipped up so that it sticks up higher. That was the problem here. You can see that unfortunately, it did not bode well when someone tried to go under an overpass. Uh-oh, no, no, yeah. Bam. Yeah, didn't work out well. This dump truck with a raised bed slammed into this overpass. They just played over and over and over again. It's like, you know, no, you wish you could stop him. Crunch. It's an unfortunate situation. It's really quite a hit. And it happened in Virginia. The overpass smacking right into there, the dump truck smacking right into the overpass. The whole thing was caught on the dashboard camera on Interstate 66 in Fairfax County, right at the Fairfax County Parkway overpass there. It's an unfortunate thing. No injuries reported, no other vehicles damaged. It's unclear why the truck's trailer was raised or whether the driver was aware of it before this impact. But yikes, that's not pretty. Uh-oh. I've seen people do that at drive-thrus where they have the bar that hangs down, or in parking garages that are also too low. Nope. This will be exciting for gamers in the crowd. They've got a new... I'm not going to call it a Nintendo Switch. They say it's the post-cursor to the Nintendo Switch. It's the successor, is what it is. The long-awaited successor to the popular Switch console is in the works. Nintendo is saying that they might have to wait more than a year before they try out this new console. My son loves the Switch because you can take it with you, play it in the car on a road trip, or you can hook it up to your TV and play it on the big screen. It was first released in 2017. They think that it'll be called Switch 2, but they don't really know. No one really knows because Nintendo isn't announcing that, but they have confirmed plans as to when they will make the announcement and give more information. The company's president says the next gen console will be announced within this fiscal year. Nintendo's 2024 fiscal year ends March 31st of 2025. So they think the Nintendo Switch 2, is what they're calling it now, should be officially announced by next April. We don't know how different it is or whether the graphics are going to be different, but I'm sure there's a lot of people excited about this. This story is for Wes, who, by the way, contributed to the show twice this week, and I'm really, really grateful. So this story is for Wes, who, by the way, loves to kind of recreate Star Wars figures. And I love watching what he does with Yoda on Facebook and 3D printing. So interesting. Well, there are some engineers at the National Air and Space Museum that have unveiled a drone outfitted with body shells that resemble the X-Wing fighter. It's kind of cool looking. I have a picture for you. Here it is. Look at that. Nice, right? Yeah. And so they did it. They unveiled it in honor of May the 4th. May the 4th be with you. It weighs about 1,000 pounds, and it was first remotely piloted with electric vertical takeoff and landing of its size, approved by the FAA for public demonstration. The making of this X-Wing fighter says it captures the imagination and also furthers technology. Kind of cool. the company, Walt Disney Imagineering, which is the research and development arm of Disney, says they figured this technology could be used for entertainment. And so Disney and Boeing met in 2017 to look at these plans. And they say they're always looking for what other cool things could we do? How could we make really cool new experiences? And what are the technologies that we could use to make their guests and the audiences think they're seeing magic? When really it's just a bunch of high-tech stuff. This X-Wing on display is about 3/4 of the size of one in the fictional world. It's made mostly of carbon fiber, has 12 electronic motors. It can fly for about 5 minutes. The skin of the aircraft that makes it look like an X-Wing is produced with ultraviolet reactive ink. When it's flying, they say, we light this with basically a big giant black light, like a spotlight, that makes the parts we want you to see super visible, and the parts we don't want you to see just go away back into the darkness. They demonstrated it at Galaxy's Edge. They have the drones that they were doing. And they said the operators of this are highly trained pilots. They expect this drone to stay on the floor of a museum for a couple of years. It's being suspended in the air like other aircraft in the collection here. So kind of cool. This is at the National Air and Space Museum, this drone with an X-Wing body shell. There you go. We did not need this, but apparently McDonald's is going to give it to us anyway. Because I guess we need a bigger burger. This is the double Big Mac, where they have two patties on top and two patties on bottom. And I put this in because they don't give us a picture yet of what this new burger is going to be. But they will say at McDonald's they're working on something big. Something really big. The move is coming because people say inflation is making them eat out less. That they're paying more and they're getting less. So McDonald's apparently thought, well, let's make a bigger burger then. The bigger burger is, I don't know, it doesn't have a name. What they're calling it is the larger satiating burger. That's the name we're going with now. The larger satiating burger. They're going to put it in test markets once they develop it. And I guess it's going to be a big, chunky burger. Yeah. Isn't it? Other countries say the portion size in America is huge, that we eat bigger portions of meals than around the world. So is giving us another giant satiating burger really what we needed? I don't know. But McDonald's says a nationwide value message could be good news for consumers where the price of the soon-to-be-launched larger satiating burger is concerned. They think they need to do something because traffic at fast food restaurants in the 1/4 of this year was down or flat in the United States and Australia, the United Kingdom, Germany, Canada, and Japan as well. And they say that consumer is very discriminating on how they spend their dollar. So perhaps you want the bigger satiating burger. Maybe that's where you want to spend your dollar. I don't know. I'm thinking not. Mm-mm. How about this story? Another sciencey story. Am I getting a little too sciencey today? I don't know. This is a story about weird, complex creatures emerging on Earth more than 500 million years ago. For a long time, people wondered why. Why did these complex creatures emerge? How did life begin? Well, now some scientists, think they know why. They think the Earth's magnetic field has played a key role in making our planet habitable. That the protective bubble over our atmosphere shields our planet from solar radiation, winds, cosmic rays, wild swings in temperature. But 591 million years ago, the Earth's magnetic field almost collapsed. And that is the change they think may have played a pivotal role in helping complex life blossom. In general, this field is protective. If we didn't have a field early in Earth's history, water would have been stripped from the planet by solar wind. It's important. But they said we had a fascinating period in the development of the deep Earth, with the process creating the magnetic field, had become so inefficient after billions of years that the field almost completely collapsed. The study is found in the journal Communications Earth and Environment. It found that the Earth's magnetic field, created by the motion of the molten iron in the Earth's outer core, was significantly weaker than its current strength for a period of about 26 million years. And it's that discovery of the weakening of the Earth's magnetic field, they think, helped resolve an enduring geological mystery about when the solid inner core of our planet was formed. It's the time when the first complex animals emerged on the seafloor, and the percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere and the oceans increased. Those weird animals barely resembled life today. They were squashy fans, they were donuts, they were tubes, they were slug-like. There was one called the Kimberella. We like that one. And before that, life had been single-celled and microscopic. And so the researchers think that a weak magnetic field may have led to an increase in oxygen in the atmosphere, allowing early complex life to evolve. How cool is that? I don't know how you prove it, but I like it. You see this? That's Coit Tower. And look at the laser lights coming off the top of it. Yeah, beautiful. And apparently you could see it from 12 miles away. This giant mysterious laser beam appearing over San Francisco. See it from all over the place. And people were thinking, why is it here? Who's doing this? What's going on? Apparently, one person, so curious, they drove right over, rode their bike over to see what's going on out there. It's a mega laser. The company is named Mega Lasers. They're testing this 400-watt beam in the Coit Tower parking lot for an upcoming conference. The CEO of Mega Laser says it's a fun art project, but it's also a fun celebration of their security company. They said they've had people from all over San Francisco coming to ask about it. They do have approval from the FAA because lasers like this can interfere with flight operations. The installation is going to be visible in the same area again tonight from 8 to 11 p.m. So if you're in the city, near the city, and you see the laser lights coming from Coit Tower, that's what's going on in this area. Loving it. All right. I guess it's time to end the show. I barely feel like I've gotten started. And now it's time to end already because I can't keep you guys all afternoon. And I had so much more to say. But we'll get to it tomorrow. Tomorrow, by the way, is Trivia Thursday. Thursday trivia. So we'll do that. We have a great show coming up on the Nikki Maduro show on Thursday. You're going to love the topic. That show is nearly a half an hour, starts at 10 tomorrow. Again, on the Nikki Maduro show Friday, we'll be live for the Mother's Day show. So that'll be fun. Tomorrow on the Mark Thompson show, it's David Katz Day, and there's so much to ask him about. So that's going to be really fun. And then we're back here for trivia on Thursday here on the After Party Live. Can I ask you to please click the like button? And I'm really trying to work up to 2,000 subscribers. 1,907 as of last night. So if you can subscribe, if you haven't already, I'd really appreciate that. And again, the PayPal information is in the show description if you are so moved to do that. So before I check out, and tomorrow is Friday Eve, Wes, before I check out, oh no, I wanted to check in with you in the chat. Heather's going to miss tomorrow because of stupid work. The good news is the show is recorded and it lives in YouTube infamy, so you can find it whenever you need to, but we'll miss you in the chat, Heather. You're always super funny and entertaining, and you make me chuckle after I go back and read everything after the show. B.A. Ware says, hopefully we'll be able to watch the first 15 minutes of the show. Wouldn't that be nice, B.A. Ware? Someone needs to have my cell phone to text me when I'm not on. Someone needs to say, no, this isn't working out. Yeah. I know I'm late because my son just walked in from school, so I'll end the show. Thank you for being with me again. Thank you to all the people who contribute to the After Party Live. You are so appreciated, and I will see you guys tomorrow. Have a great day. Make it a really good one. Bye-bye.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.
Send it.
Mm. Oh.